call to order this hearing of the Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes. Tuesday, April 9th, 2013. We're going to start hearing bills. We'll revert back to approving the minutes when we have established a quorum. Senator Pratt, Senate File 949. Welcome to the committee, Senator Pratt. We're pleased to hear your proposal and very interested in it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm pleased to be in front of the committee to introduce Senate File 949, a bill to exempt sales tax for construction materials and capital investment in the industrial measurement, manufacturing, and controls industry. In short, this bill will require a total capital require the company getting the tax exemption, the total capital investment of at least $60 million, the creation of at least 250 new jobs, and will require certification by deed. These facilities are terrific opportunities for our state to attract and retain good-paying jobs, and especially when we have partnerships with our local communities. To talk about the immediate examples that we've got are representatives from Shakopee, Mayor Brad Tapke, and our representatives from Emerson. And so I'll turn it over to Mayor Tapke.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Brad Tapke. I'm Mayor Shakopee.
Welcome to the committee, and you've just stated your name for the record, so we're happy to have your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brad Tapke, Mayor Shakopee. And we are here today, as Senator Pratt explained, as a partnership between the City of Shakopee, Scott County, Burnsville, Egan Savage School District, Deed, Greater MSP, and also the Governor's Office. And we've been working very hard on a proposal, putting together a package to create 500 high-paying manufacturing and engineering jobs in Shakopee. These will all be brand-new jobs. So we're talking about 500 direct jobs as well as an additional 1,200 indirect jobs from an economic impact study from Greater MSP. This is a $70 million project asking to exempt the sales tax for up to, I believe the number is $800,000. We have a building in Shakopee that's 13 years old. It's 500,000 square feet. It was built by ADC 13 years ago, and it was shelled out and has never been occupied. So it's on 110 acres, and we would very much like to see activity and jobs created in this spot right in the heart of the industrial section of Shakopee. So if Emerson grows their company in Shakopee, in the first 5 years alone, it will create $62.5 million in wages and also bring $3.1 million of state tax revenue generated by the employees. So we think this is a very good job for our community, for the metro, and also for the state. So we hope that you will be able to support this. And some more information on Emerson, I'll turn it over if you choose to Brian Harstead from Emerson.
Good morning. My name is Brian Harstead. I'm the Vice President of Finance for Rosemount's North America operations. Rosemount is the Minnesota-based company that was founded back in 1956. Our parent Emerson is in St. Louis, Missouri. And we've been working together, as Mayor Tapke said, for several months now to put this package together that could lead to a significant investment and an opportunity to put high-quality manufacturing jobs here into our local region and continue to build our Minnesota operations. We manufacture and design process instrumentation that is used in safety and quality applications. Our biggest growth in the past few years has been with the energy markets, and that growth in energy, oil and gas, and refining has led us to a point where we need additional facility space to serve our North America business. And this Shakopee facility has one of the best options that we've identified. We're still looking at multiple locations, but the Shakopee facility is really shaping up to be a very good option for us. Initially, the project didn't compare as favorably with some of our other lower cost location options, but working with Mayor Tapke, the county, the school districts, the state offices, we've been able to put together a package which, if approved, we believe makes this a very viable project. As we mentioned, we believe that over the next 5 years, we'll be investing nearly $70 million in this manufacturing facility, creating about 200 additional plant positions and 300 management, engineering, and support roles for that new factory in Shakopee. And that would grow our Minnesota headcount with Rosemount from about 2,000 currently, adding 500 on top of that. We would continue to maintain our Chanhassen and Eden Prairie locations, and this would really give us a three primary facilities in the Southwest Metro area for our global headquarters and our main manufacturing locations for North America. So we're pleased to be able to talk with you this morning and appreciate your support with this package.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Claire Roebling. I'm the Communications and Legislative Coordinator for Scott County. And as you've heard, this is an exciting project, and Scott County is excited about it, and we would love to have them be part of our community. I don't know if anyone mentioned yet, but there is a facility that has been sitting there empty for a number of years. It's the old ADC building. You may recall when we had a proposal for a Viking stadium down in Scott County in Shakopee. It would have been on this site, but we are trying to repurpose this building, and they actually would use the shell that has been built but was never completed for their new facility. So that's exciting for us to have that used for a good purpose. 200 manufacturing jobs and 300 professional jobs is something that our county board has looked very favorably on, and they have already approved a property tax abatement valued at $571,000. Plus, we have a fiber optic line that we are willing to negotiate and have them hook on to it at great savings, and so we're hoping that is another possible incentive. But as mentioned, this would bring a lot of additional revenue into our local communities, but also to the state through the sales tax, but also through property taxes, through the statewide property tax. And there would be about $100,000 a year just for the fiscal disparities pool that is not being abated, and so it would still be coming in. So we just think that this is something that we do want here. We know we're in competition with some other areas, and we are trying to help put together a package that would be attractive so we can help them grow here in Minnesota. And I think that's it if there's questions.
Well, I think, you know, it's helpful to go back over the bill itself, and I think it's important that there are benchmarks that have to be reached. And you mentioned that you were, I think you mentioned the number 70 million, but the benchmark is $60 million of investment, and then 250 full-time equivalent employees that are new employees, and that it has to be certified by deed. And then everything has to happen, the refund applied for, all those conditions met before it's granted. In some of the bills that we have dealing with this, these kind of issues that we've been hearing lately, there's been an average wage that's part of it. I think some of the angel investment credit has, I don't remember what the level is, but I wonder if you could talk to us about what kind of jobs we're talking about. Are we talking about $20 an hour jobs, $13 an hour jobs, which we would be far less interested in, you know, $60,000 a year salaries? What kind of jobs would be coming here? Could you characterize those for us, please?
Certainly, yep. Madam Chair, thank you for the question on that. The two types of jobs, as I mentioned, the manufacturing positions are plant assembly labor.
Could you bring the microphone closer?
Okay. Thank you. The manufacturing assembly jobs, which are estimated to be about 200 in this new factory, would have starting wages of in the $13 to $14 an hour as a minimum. That's our starting point. But today, those positions in our current factory in Chanhassen average wage exclusive of benefits is about $17 an hour. And we would expect to duplicate that type of group in the Shakopee facility. The other positions are primarily salaried positions, either management roles overseeing the manufacturing area or engineering positions.
And are those new positions as well?
New positions as well. And the salaried positions generally would start at a minimum of around $50,000 salaried exclusive of benefits, again, with an average ranging closer to $65,000 to $70,000. So these are high-quality, technical-related positions primarily.
Do you would you have a huge problem with having some sort of demonstrating the level of pay for these jobs, understanding that they're different types and that would be part of it?
Yes.
Is that a problem?
Madam Chair, that would be acceptable. In fact, in the local agreement with the city and county that we've just finished working through as well, we've defined two different groups of employee counts with a minimum average for each of those two. So I think we could adopt a similar language.
Yeah, Senator Pratt, if you would provide us with that language, please.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Okay. Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 949?
Madam Chair, I do have
Senator Pratt.
One quick amendment, if I could.
Okay.
Quick oral amendment on line 2.7 to change the date from December 31st, 2015 to January 1, 2016.
Could you repeat that?
Yes, on line 2.7, strike December 31, 2015, and insert January 1, 2016. It's an author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Any further discussion on Senate File 949? Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so I've got my notes correct, I think I've got 200 manufacturing positions, and what was the number of management salaried positions again?
Senator, the total growth that we expect to have is 500 positions in total, so 200 manufacturing and 300 in the salary side.
Okay, great. And your total then is 2,500. I think my memory's not very good, and I didn't hear that you brought this up, but is there about a $1.4 million local effort to this project?
Property tax abatements, I think
property
you mentioned.
Property tax abatements,
yes.
And stuff.
We'll have Mayor Tapke.
Yes, there is. The City of Shakopee has put together a package that we have $1.4 million from the city from abatement and other items that we've worked on. There is from the county, there's abatement as well, about the same amount of abatement as well as over $1 million worth of fiber network. ISD 191, Burnsville, Egan Savage has put together $366,925 abatement, and then the state also has other MIF funds and things that they're working toward the project.
Yeah.
So our goal is to be around $6 million.
And then this $800 would be on top of the $1.4 million local?
Yes.
Okay,
yep.
Great.
Yep, we're hoping to have the $800 as part of the $6 million package.
I was interested in Ms. Roebling's comments about not asking to be excused from fiscal disparities, Senator Scoy. I want to know whether this project is in a TIF district.
This project is not in a TIF district, no.
Okay, thank you.
Originally, when the building was built, was intended to be built 13 years ago, it was there was abatement attached to it, but since the jobs never occurred, none of the abatement happened.
Okay. Any other questions or comments for Senator Pratt or his testifiers on Senate File 949? Seeing none, Senate File 949 as amended is laid over. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Senator Roebling. We do now have a quorum. If you would, members would review the minutes from Thursday, April 4th, 2013. Are there any corrections? And seeing none, Senator Coonan moves approval of the Adoption of the amendments. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The next bill is Senate File 868, Senator Schmidt. And members, with regard to Senator Pratt's proposal, there was on April 6th, there was a short article in the Star Tribune about this project. If you're interested in it, we can provide copies of it. Very interesting. Okay, so now we have Senator Schmidt's bill, 868, data centers. Senator Schmidt.
All right. Madam Chair and members of the committee, it's good to be with you here today. I was speaking to Senate File 868 here, and what this does is that it expands the qualifications for a qualified data center. We currently have in statute a couple of, benchmarks designating data centers to receive a sales tax exemption for technology equipment and software purchase and investment. What this bill does, it expands those thresholds and changes from 30,000 feet to 25,000 feet, the square footage threshold that would trigger that sales tax exemption. Similarly, it reduces the minimum required investment in construction or refurbishment of technology equipment or software from $50 million down to $20 million that would trigger that sales tax exemption. And third, it expands the time in which the qualifying investment must be made from a 24-month period to a 48-month period. So essentially what we're trying to do is we're expanding the qualification criteria so that more data centers could qualify for the sales tax exemption. What we also do in this bill is add a definition and some clarity in terms of what is meant by software and computer software in particular. So very technical, I guess, in nature. But what we're trying to do here is incent investment in data centers. And in members, data centers are not call centers that you might think of when you receive a telemarketing call or something like that. Rather, data centers are the back office investment, the physical place where a lot of this data that our businesses and our commerce generate in our way of life really generates and it's stored. When you think of the cloud, you can think of data centers, and that's where that information is stored. Minnesota happens to be a pretty good place for these sorts of investments. We feel that data centers spur economic growth. You can utilize them for innovation incubators and spurring on innovation and entrepreneurialism. It's something that can be located really in any community, large or small, depending upon their telecommunications infrastructure. And this is an incentive that tries to capture a share of that market here in Minnesota. They tend to be well-paying jobs. And I think Minnesota is ripe for further investment in this area. So what we're trying to do is create or expand incentives for that sort of investment. So with that said, we do have some testimony here.
Senator Schmidt, do you have an amendment for your bill?
You know, there is a technical amendment I'd be happy to offer it at this okay. time.
Well, you can't offer it, but one of us.
Oh, I suppose.
there's an author's amendment, an A1 amendment. It's being distributed. We'll make sure everybody gets it. And you have a copy, Senator Schmidt?
No, I actually do not have a copy, okay, so I'd like to see one.
I want Senator Schmidt to see it before we act on it. Is this the amendment you want?
This is the amendment.
Senator Eaton offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We'll listen to your testifiers, and then I have a question for the Department of Revenue, so I hope Commissioner Von Mosch is here. Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record, we'll hear your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Tollefson, and I'm the Manager of Public Policy for the Minnesota High Tech Association. And we come to support the bill, and we thank you for hearing it today, and thank Senator Schmidt for bringing this forward. The bill adjusts the current qualified data center tax exemption to make it better fit the industry as it operates today. So the original law was passed in order to attract data centers to Minnesota, but the numbers turned out to be too large for most data center developers and operators. In fact, only one company that we know of has utilized the exemption. Minnesota has a number of barriers to entry, and we currently lag behind other states in terms of the incentives we provide companies to build data centers here. The Minnesota High Tech Association's goal is to make Minnesota one of the top five high-tech corridors in the country, fueling Minnesota's prosperity through innovation and technology. Attracting data centers and building Minnesota's reputation as a logical place to build those data centers are key elements to that goal. We were supportive of the original incentive, and we thank the committee for passing that. And we now would like to expand the opportunity to other companies. The current incentive requires an investment of $50 million over 2 years, which turns out to be just too much too fast for most companies. This language would change requirements to $20 million over 4 years, a much more likely investment given today's data center needs. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Sir? If you'd identify yourself, please, for the committee and the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is John Livingston. I'm president of HyberData, a data center development company. A big part of my job is to promote data center construction in Minnesota. Our state's natural Midwest cool environment and well-educated people make it an excellent location for data centers. We suffer from a severe demand imbalance in this state. This reality is faced by startup and enterprise companies whose growth is increasingly tied to the internet. Because of their needs are underserved in Minnesota, they often find providers outside of the state. Minnesota competes with the rest of the country for data center development, so the proposed language will help level the playing field with other states, many of whom offer incentives far beyond what's considered here. These language adjustments directly relate to projects currently being considered. Large-scale developments such as Google, Apple, or Microsoft don't have the same objectives as co-location data centers. Most data center needs are smaller with gradual increases. Unlike those large companies, most co-location data centers are used by a wide range of customers, sizes, and needs. A typical facility will take 12 to 18 months to construct, and after construction, the servers and computers are installed. So our current timetable is too short for the realities of most companies. A $20 million project would require $5 million of construction labor, and then have about $10 to $20 million worth of computers installed. Highly skilled people are needed to maintain and operate this equipment as well as manage the servers, so the job's impact reaches far beyond the data center property line. I thank you for this opportunity and ask you to support these changes.
Any questions for the testifiers or Senator Schmidt? You know, I like this bill because even though or at least information we have, like data centers like to be in a cool climate.
That's right.
They don't have to be in the metropolitan area. And so they can be, you know, this can be an economic opportunity for cities, regional centers in greater Minnesota, just as well as seven-county metropolitan area. So, but I do have a question for the department.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Scoy, before they come up.
Thank you. Senator Schmidt, or to your testifiers, I too am intrigued by this, and I have a question for the department. But I'm looking at, you know, some of what you're doing to make this easier for companies to qualify, and the cost of this is a little over $4 million in this biennium and a little over $13 million in the next biennium. It appears like this is all scalable, so if we do happen to decide to move forward with parts of this, when you look at this, is the square footage more important than the dollar threshold, or is the time period? Do you have some priorities in the four activities that are in this bill that if we could do parts of it and not all of it? Have you thought about any of that?
Yeah, that was going to be my question, too, of the department. Which of the factors in here drive the cost? So, Senator Schmidt, is the four-year threshold most important, or the dollar amount, or the square footage? What's the critical factor that, you know, sine qua non, without which we don't get anywhere?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, I'll certainly defer to my experts here on either side of me, but I think that these are in here for a reason. They all play important roles in determining which sort of data center should qualify. I'll allow the gentleman on my left and right here to speak to their perspectives, but I think that it's important that these all be in here in some form or fashion.
Wrong answer, sir.
Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, the $50 million threshold is really too high. That is for more enterprise development, so big companies who are creating huge data centers. And the trend now is to do more co-location. So you have smaller data centers and then even smaller companies who are using a certain amount of space in each data center to house their data needs. So they work together with the developers to, and then the operators to lease a certain amount of space. And so that $50 million threshold to begin with is too high, but then the time requirement to get, you know, tenants into these data centers, the co-location data centers, takes a long time. And then, as John can explain, the building itself can take 18 months to build, and then that, under current law, would only leave 6 months to put all of the electrical and data equipment into there to qualify for this need. So it really is all three of those issues that affect the development. But I'd like to encourage you to hear John Livingston speak about the demand.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the three aspects are integral to almost every company that we've worked with that's interested in developing in this state. Most of them aren't big enterprise companies such as Google or Microsoft, so they're not deploying this for a specific need. They're deploying it to develop a business, and their risk demands that they find a customer, find a location. So incrementally, all three of these components all interrelate. The size becomes a function of how many racks and servers they can put in, which becomes a function of how useful they can be to the potential tenants they'll have, which could be anywhere from, you know, companies like Medtronic down to, you know, XYZ company that we've never heard of before. So the period of time that it takes to build a building combined with how long it takes them to get a customer is all part of the concern they have of whether they should deploy in this state or deploy someplace else. And so
you
we're
say
just
there's only been one company that's taken advantage of this? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, as far as we know, that's true. And to give you an example, that's a huge company in United Health Group using a data center like this. But most companies don't have the needs in this area. And to give a little history on data centers, you know, because of speed changes over the last 10 years or so, data centers can really exist anywhere in the country now. Before, they had to exist along that main corridor that went down New York, Washington, Texas, Los Angeles, and so forth. But now, because of speed, we can have them here in Minnesota. And we do have a little bit more of a natural advantage with the lower energy costs, but other states are providing incentives and are really trying hard to compete. And this bill doesn't even go that far. We can utilize our natural advantages with these provisions.
Where are most new data centers being set up or established? And could we get information on what those states do in terms of the incentives? Senator Schmidt, could you help us out with that, please?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. And I have a question then for our
go ahead, Senator, after you.
For the department.
Yeah, before the department.
Okay.
Gentlemen, you've addressed the three space, dollar, and time period. I'm most concerned about the provisions on page two dealing with computer software, and that's the question that I'm going to have for the department.
That's but mine, too.
If you would want to address that prior to the department coming up, because I'm reading in the revenue analysis that they're saying computer software activities that count as refurbishment, the addition of these. What's the importance of that language, and is that something that would be critical? Because it appears to me that software becomes dated so quick.
Further question for the department is that I'd like to know to what extent that new language, Senator Skoy, contributes to the revenue estimate.
Absolutely.
I mean, if it's technical or if it's not.
My question actually is going back to the square footage. So could I ask it? Should I ask it now while we're waiting for the department, or
ask whatever you'd like?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I have a data center in my district that was looking at expanding, and the single parcel and contiguous parcels. Did you guys have any discussion on would there be companies expanding size if it didn't have to be in the contiguous parcel? So they might have a location in, say, northeast Minneapolis that they are physically unable to expand, And so they were, you know, they might actually be over the 30,000 square footage, and they were going to expand into Southwestern Metro, but they weren't anywhere near the 30,000. Was there any discussions on, is there anybody, if they didn't have to be contiguous parcels?
Senator Schmidt.
You know, Madam Chair and Senator, I don't have, a specific answer for you in that regard. I mean, I think the idea here is to incent this sort of investment, and in my mind, it doesn't necessarily have to be contiguous. But I would probably want to hear from the department on that question and see what they would have to say.
Okay, so thank you, gentlemen. Ms. Von Mosch, can you join us, please? Ms. Von Mosch, I think you've heard the discussion. We're trying to isolate what figures drive the revenue estimate, and in particular, the issue of contiguity of the parcels. If that would make a difference, that's not in the revenue estimate. I think it assumes that there is no. We're not talking about non-contiguous parcels, but Senator Scoy and I are concerned about how technical or non-technical the language about computer software is that's being added to the definitions. If you'd respond to that, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Susan Von Mosch from the Department of Revenue. And I am afraid I may have to check back with our tax research division to see to what extent what costs are, in fact, driving the estimate. I don't have that information right now, and I'll have to check with them in terms of how they made the estimate.
We're very interested in knowing that information.
But you are particularly interested in lines 215 through 217 on the second page. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's what Senator Scoy and I are looking at.
Okay. I can check with them right now. I can give them a call and I don't know if you'll be done talking about this bill, but I'd have to check with them to see
at some point if you
how they weighted
us
the different factors in making the revenue estimate.
Thank you. Is there further questions, sir? Go ahead.
Could I, John Tollefson again, Madam Chair? Could I add that this is the software issue is, and I haven't seen the Department of Revenue's estimate, so we'll look at those and give you more information about that. From our perspective, but that
we'll
is one of the.
You, we'll get you a copy of that.
Well, that's fine. That's one of. But just generally speaking, Madam Chair, on the software issue, that's one of the significant costs of data center expansion, and we believe that this bill, with the revenue estimates and so forth on current projects, but the purpose of this bill is to incent companies to come from across the country into Minnesota, and we hope and plan on this being actually revenue positive for the state eventually.
Mr. Tollefson, unfortunately, we cannot do dynamic scoring with these bills.
No, certainly not, Madam Chair.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Scoy, and we're going to move on.
To the software, but if we're giving a four-year sales tax exemption that's cumulative for purchases and you're purchasing software, it seems to me that that's kind of an ongoing thing because it becomes out of date and then you buy it more and you up the grade. And I mean, it would be a continual cycle of exemption on the software component. So I'm concerned about that.
We'll get a definite.
Madam Chair and Senator, I'm sensitive to your concerns, and I'll try to offer some more specificity there. I think the software that we're trying to define here is not the typical software that we'd be banding about here at the Capitol, but it's specific to data centers and their operations, and we'll make sure we come back to you with.
If you would work, Senator Schmidt, with the department and getting answers to our questions, we would appreciate it very much.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Is there further discussion or testimony on Senate File 868? Anybody else want to say anything?
Let's do.
Okay. Seeing none, Senate File 868, as amended, is laid over. Thank you very much, Senator Schmidt. Senator Ingebrigtsen, Critical Access Dental Provider Sales Tax Exemption, Senate File 621. Senator Ingebrigtsen, you have an amendment as well. Is that correct?
I do, Madam Chair. Thank you.
The amendment to 621. Wait for it to get distributed. Senator Ingebrigtsen, do you have a copy of it yourself?
I do not.
We'll make sure you get a copy before
thank you.
We act on it. Senator Ingebrigtsen, is the A1 amendment the amendment you want offered?
Madam Chair, thank you. The A1 amendment is quite self-explanatory. It deals with the portion of the bill that
Is this the language you want?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Senator Eaton offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for hearing this very important bill today. Senate File 621, as amended before you. With me today, I have Dr. Richard Mohn from the Board of Directors of the Caring Hands Dental Clinic. Unable to be here is Al Olson. Both of these gentlemen have been working on this critical access issue for the Caring Hands Clinic in Alexandria for several years. In fact, I think 5 years running. He wasn't able to make it today because his mother is very ill, and it doesn't sound like she's going to be doing very well. So we're going to miss him today. But Dr. Mohn has been down here testifying several times, and I'll have him do that. But a little explanation of the bill, if I may, Madam Chair and members. Under current law, qualifying sales to a hospital or outpatient surgical centers receive an upfront sales tax exemption. This bill extends that sales tax exemption to critical access dental care providers as defined under current law. Critical access dental providers are generally nonprofit organizations that serve low-income, special needs, and underserved patients. This bill also requires that the critical access dental center must serve only recipients of the Minnesota health care programs, such as MinCare, General Assistance, Medical Care, and Medical Assistance. The exemption does not extend to purchases made by the medical facility, not operating as a critical access dental provider. Building construction materials for buildings would not qualify for any sales tax exemptions. This bill also deals with the retroactivity of the purchases from June of 2007. And as you can see, the amendment, Madam Chair and members, gives this group an opportunity to recover those sales tax exemptions up until June 20th of 2014. That's previous sales tax exemptions. So,
thank you.
With that, Madam Chair, a fiscal note, you notice an estimate is pending. Dr. Mohn can address some of those issues that may be of interest to you. He does have some numbers with him. And it's also to note on the bottom there, it's today two clinics that would qualify for the proposed exemption have been identified, but not the total number is known yet. A final estimate will be completed when pending information from the Minnesota Department of Revenue is received. Madam Chair and members, we can certainly stand for questions, but if I could have Dr. Mohn testify a little bit about the critical access, and if you have any questions, we'll certainly.
Dr. Mohn, well, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. I'm
and
Dr.
If you do know how many critical access dental facilities there are, just from your own personal knowledge, that would be very helpful to us.
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Richard Mohn. I'm a retired dentist, recently moved to Alexandria. I'm on the board of directors for the Caring Hands Dental Clinic in Alexandria. We are a clinic, what I would like to qualify as a true nonprofit dental clinic. Board directors are unpaid. We do not accept private pay patients. We only see state program patients or unable to pay patients. So last year we did somewhere in the neighborhood of $25,000 of free dentistry, just for the record on that. It's important to distinguish the nonprofit status. We kind of like to think of ourselves as a true nonprofit as opposed to we see the what appears to be for-profit nonprofits. And so we want to guarantee you that we're not going down the slippery slope of trying to let them get in on what's going on here. As you are well aware of, in the your Office of Legislative Audits just came out recently and really was pretty tough on DHS handling of dental reimbursements. Without the generosity of numerous local businesses and foundations such as Otto Bremer and stuff, our clinic would not be able to function with only the reimbursements from the state. We last year, I think, was close to $130,000 worth of donations by foundations and local people. The reason we're doing this is we're trying to keep the doors open on the clinic. And it's not a big dollar amount in your world of taxes and DHS budgets and stuff like that, but in our world, $20,000, which is the sales tax we paid since 07, the retroactive dollar, the $20,639, is a big deal for us. Going forward, we estimate probably $600 a month in sales tax would be saved. So we're looking at high-end $8,000 a year in sales tax going forward. You asked a question about number of clinics. To my knowledge, we're kind of a one-of-a-kind animal. There's possibly one in Bemidji. Princeton, City of Princeton, is looking at our model, trying to develop what we have going. We started out as an all-volunteer clinic probably 7 years ago in response to the number of dental emergencies that were showing up in the emergency room at the hospital.
And this is strictly emergency care.
No, we do full care now.
We do full care.
We are creating a dental home.
Okay, and turning cleaning and
preventive care as well as the full care for
no orthodontia.
No orthodontia. But
extractions and things.
Extractions, fillings, partial dentures, dentures, the whole, you know, full service for a dental clinic.
Okay.
As opposed to, I know down in Rochester they've got an emergency care clinic that 50-some doctors volunteer at, and that's mostly just extractions, emergency extractions. Okay. Our goal is to get most of those emergency room visits out of there. They should be in a dental clinic because emergency room visit typically is antibiotics, pain meds, go see your dentist. 6 weeks are back, antibiotics, pain meds, go see your dentist. And the Douglas County Hospital is estimated we've saved them over $100,000 since our clinic opened in emergency room costs.
Senator Skoy and then Senator Excel. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe there is one in Bemidji, but isn't there one called Green Tree somewhere down in central Minnesota?
Not to my knowledge. It could be.
I think there might be a few of these around.
Yeah. Again,
not enough,
I know you're not talking about Apple Tree, are you?
Apple Tree. That's
Apple Tree is what we call a nonprofit. They take private pay.
Oh, so they wouldn't qualify for this?
No.
Okay.
No, and we did that by design to narrow that definition down just because most of the clinics, any clinic developed of our, like us, call it a strange animal, is most times started by volunteer dentists. Most of your volunteer dentists you don't want to compete against, so you don't want to take private pay. And that's how you keep your volunteers coming. So ours has evolved because of the need was so high. And, of course, we have Prime West in Alexandria, too, if you're familiar with the county-based purchasing, the 13 counties, I think it is, up to now. And they were also instrumental in getting this clinic going. There is such a need just through Prime West, plus all the MinCare and all the medical assistance and stuff, that last summer we took a leap of faith and we actually went to a full-time clinic. That's where we went out and hit the Otto Bremer foundations and local people to get, buy equipment to staff. We have two full-time dentists and staff to support that. We do outreach clinics. We're going now into grade schools and identifying either Head Start children or medical assistance children and doing exams, prophys, x-rays. We have digital equipment now to be able to, and handheld digital x-ray machines to be able to do full dental prophylactic hygiene exams in the schools with portable chairs, the whole nine yards. And so that's part of our philosophy has been to create a dental home for these this clientele. They have been shuffled around and pushed around in emergency rooms and emergency care. We're trying to break that cycle and create dental homes, and so that's where this clinic is stepping in. So, again, going back to the, you know, that's kind of the warm fuzzies of our clinic and what we're trying to accomplish out there. We're all about quality care. We're not about becoming whatever you want, a dental factory. We don't want to just shovel through to get the fee. We're mm-hmm. all about the quality care and making a home.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the doctor, first of all, I want to give you a heartfelt thank you. What you guys are doing really is very, very commendable.
Appreciate that.
And I didn't hear how many patients. You said it. I just didn't get that number.
Patient numbers? I think this year, because we went to a full-time staff in July, we don't have annual numbers yet. We're working on that. But I think our patient records we have is close to 5,000 in our clinic, and the number of actual patient visits will approach probably 2,500 a year.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and
Senator Gazelka,
Doctor, because if we're talking about a few clinics doing this, and I think you mentioned around $8,000 in sales tax as a cost. I think that was the number.
Actually, I said 7,000 to 8,000 a year annual is what we're projecting.
Yeah, and so if we're looking at, you know, even if there is a number of clinics and you guys are completely taking care of those that have no resources, can't take care of themselves, I can't imagine the fiscal note being very high, but the impact that you guys are having is profound. And so thank you, and this would be something I hope we find a way to do.
And just to follow up on that, we have done all the channels. We are a federally qualified clinic. We went jumped through all the hoops because we were hoping to get loan forgiveness for dental graduates, and that's quite the game. We'll never qualify for that. Unless you're on an Indian Health Board or a situation, you just don't qualify for that. And at this point, there's no loan forgiveness on the state level either for this. So.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Mullen. Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen, for bringing this bill to us. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 621? Seeing none, Senate File 621, as amended, is laid over. Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Eaton. Senator Eaton brings us Senate File 1203, and there is an A1 amendment. The bill summary is drawn to the amendment. As I mentioned, it is in your packets. Senator Eaton, do you have the amendment?
I do.
Okay. Senator Eaton moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 1203. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 1203 as amended before us. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1203 is necessary to fix what we believe is an oversight during the implementation of the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement, which was adopted by Minnesota in the last decade. Currently, the state requires durable medical equipment sellers to pay sales tax on certain durable medical equipment items, even though the buyers cannot legally required to pay the tax. This tax is uncollectible, incalculable, and incompatible with long-time Minnesota tax policy to not tax this type of health care. I have learned this bill has been before this committee before, and for now it's fourth year, and this bill has always been supported by the Senate. I will now turn this over to Sarah Anderson of Key Medical Supply and Susan Wingert of Pediatric Home Service for a further explanation of the problem SF1203 would solve.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Anderson.
Yes.
If you would like to begin, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Certainly. And my name is Sarah Anderson. I represent Key Medical Supply and the Minnesota chapter of Medical Equipment Supplies, Suppliers and Services. And thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to talk about our bill this morning. We want to start, since the committee, many members are familiar, and we have been here before, with just a very brief explanation of the changes that occurred when we adopted the streamlined sales and use tax agreement in this area. Prior to that adoption, Minnesota had exempted sales of durable medical equipment items and their accessories, prosthetics, and orthotic devices when they were purchased or paid for by Medicare and Medicaid. And we also had a broader product exemption for durable medical equipment, supplies, prosthetics, and their accessories. The change with SSUTA eliminated the exemption for Medicare and Medicaid purchased items and also changed the product exemption. We maintained an exemption for durable medical equipment, mobility-enhancing devices, prosthetics themselves, and orthotics, some orthotics, but we made single-patient use items that were necessary for their function taxable. That created a problem for our industry because we are not able to collect tax on those items. As Senator Eaton mentioned, sales taxes is uncollectible for us. Under federal regulation, HIPAA regulations, we are limited in how we can charge insurance payers for these items, how we can even submit a claim for these items, and the coding, which there's a national standard for coding. Many of these accessories are grouped by their lead device. So the single patient use accessories, as defined under SSUTA's definition, according to the health insurance world, are considered and billed as part of the lead device. And so we don't have codes to separate out some of these items. We also don't have insurances mandated to even recognize the sales tax code. In the flyer that you were that accompanied the packet, there is a graph on page one of the handout that shows the attempts by the industry to bill the sales tax code to third-party payers. Overwhelmingly, this is not paid. It's recognized as an ineligible service, a non-covered charge, a patient responsibility, or not a covered or recognized code. We have made efforts to be the collection agent for the state per our responsibility in statute and have been unsuccessful in getting third-party payers to collect on these items. Just for the committee's information, some of the items that are taxable that became taxable are some items used by some of our most critically ill or disabled Minnesotans. Feeding systems, enteral nutrition feeding systems that replace the esophagus and allow nutrition to enter the body. The prosthetic device that's in the patient's stomach is exempt. The durable medical equipment device that regulates the speed at which formula or nutrition enters the body is exempt. But all the tubing in the middle that makes those two devices function become taxable. Another example would be a catheter is exempt as a prosthetic device. Some of the supplies necessary to insert that catheter in the body are taxable. The collection devices needed to collect the output. One item, if it's used at night, commonly hung from a bed called a drain bag, is taxable. The item used during the day, the leg bag, is non-taxable because it's worn on the body during the day. So there's just a whole host of inconsistencies in SSUTA's definitions with how the healthcare world functions. And that's makes this uncollectible.
Why, Senator Eaton, are you asking for this to be applied retroactively to 2009?
Well, there are a number of businesses. Mm-hmm. You want to explain that?
Sure. We're asking for retroactive eligibility because no business has been able to collect the sales tax since its implementation.
Oh, that's right.
There are a number of audits and appeals.
Yes, I get it.
Yep.
It hasn't been collected anyway, so why not make it retroactive? Okay.
Right. So in a brief, you know, these are kinds of some of the challenges that we faced. There are even additional challenges, but I will, since the committee has heard this before, I will spare you yeah, the lengthy details.
I think we're familiar with the inconsistencies
yes.
of the application of the
yeah.
exemption. Would you like to testify as well?
Thank you for the opportunity. It's really a hard act to follow. She knows far more about sales tax and is far more articulate.
You need to identify yourself for the record,
oh,
if you would.
Excuse me. Susan Wingert, Pediatric Home Service. I'm only here as a supporting person for Sarah. The patients we take care of are medically fragile children that live in their homes. They are the user of these products. As we all know, sales tax is a use tax. I had a sales tax audit not all that long ago, and in the process of that, it was identified that I had purchased a piece of software as an operation system. And when the auditor said, you need to pay sales tax on this, my response was, well, isn't the seller supposed to be collecting that? And they said, well, true. However, somebody is going to pay it, and the person who pays it is the user, not the seller. To support Sarah, we don't use the product. We sell the product. The product is used by somebody, in the case of my patients, someone usually under the age of 18, and most definitely in a medically fragile state. They don't have the wherewithal, nor does the Department of Revenue have the ability to go and collect those taxes from those patients. So just to reiterate, this is a non-collectible tax that I do not believe was ever intended to be utilized the way it was when it was adopted in 2005. We're asking very much
right.
for this to come yeah,
unfortunately, nevertheless, even though it's not collectible and all of that, it does carry a cost with it, but it's probably something we should be looking at to do anyway. Senator Eaton, anything further?
No, Madam Chair.
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Scoy.
Is the department going to come up and just talk briefly about the retroactive nature of this and how that all interplays? In
sure. We'll ask Ms. Von Mosch to come back. Thank you very much for your testimony. She's going to need a chair at the table. Ms. Von Mosch, you want to talk to us about the collectability issues? I think that's what Senator Scoy and the retroactivity.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members. We do all of our estimates assuming that there is full compliance. There have been some audit and some appeals issues related to this bill and the products in this bill, and so but all of our estimates are done assuming full compliance, and so that is why we are carrying the cost of this amount, and the retroactive date then is something that goes back and it relates to some of the earlier activity that is currently in appeals or has been in appeals.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Von Mosch. So has any of this been collected from anybody that you would have to refund, or is this just cleaning up the what you're carrying on your books that should have been collected?
This is basically what should have been collected.
But none of it has been.
We are working in the appeals process right now.
Thank you.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. But just for clarification, none has been collected because of the nature of how difficult it is to get. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, yes, that's my understanding, is that this has been a bit of a discussion between the department and the individual companies for a number of years.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Gazelka,
is the department supportive of this legislation to clean this up, or where is the department at?
Ms. Von Mosch.
Madam Chair, Senator, the department has, we have worked very carefully, very closely this year with the promoters of this, the advocates of this proposal to refine the numbers, and we've had a good working relationship with them. This is not in the governor's budget, so from that perspective, we're working with them to try to get a resolution, but it is not in the governor's budget right now.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify, either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 1203 as amended? Seeing none, Senate File 1203 as amended is laid over. The next bill is Senate File 1453, Senator Coonan. Senator Coonan, Senate File 1453. And there is a an author's amendment, a delete everything amendment. Senator Coonan, do you have a copy of the amendment?
Madam Chair, I have a copy. It's the A1
Senate,
amendment.
Senate File, Senator Coonan offers the A1 amendment to Senate File 1453. Does everyone have a copy? All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Coonan, Senate File 1453 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, Minnesota Electric Cooperative customers pay an upfront a portion of the cost of extending or expanding electric lines into their homes, farms, or businesses. These fees were considered contributions to the cost of distributing electricity to members and not taxable. The Department of Revenue recently began considering these charges hookup fees, which are subject to sales tax. And what's interesting is they've only done this with just a few of the electric cooperatives around the state. What the bill does, and you'll see on the language in the amendment on line 2.26, is it clarifies that a payment made to electric cooperative or public utility is a contract for improvement to real property and is not retail sale. And also you'll notice in line 2.26 that a public utility was added to the bill. This is just to clarify that ratepayers all over the state will be treated the same if they're members of elected co-op or do business with a public utility. I have with me today Mr. Joel Johnson, who will has a few more comments on the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. All I would add is, as far as we can tell, electric co-ops are the only type of utility that is now being asked to pay sales tax on these contributions in aid to construction. We've tried to get some clarification from the department, but have been unable to. And we just ask that this be put into statute to clarify that so that we're no longer being asked to apply the sales tax to these contributions.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Coonan, do you think we should give the department an opportunity to comment? Ms. Von Mosch, did you want to add anything?
Mr. Chair, this has been an interesting topic for the department because we do not have anything. The most recent thing that we could find in our documentation was from 2007 in terms of our attempt to, we sent a letter out to one of the electric utilities at that time. We believe our current position is, and we haven't been able to find any evidence to the contrary, that we really do not charge a sales tax for these hookup fees at this point in time. And we've tried to be in contact with the electric utility that is raising the concern and haven't gotten a response back from them. So we this is kind of a puzzle because there seems to be some differences of what is going on, but we believe we are not charging the sales tax for the hookup fees at this time.
So if we're to clarify this, that it appears to you that what we're doing here is in what the department believes should be occurring.
Pardon?
So what the Senator Coonan bill as amended is trying to accomplish is what the department thinks is currently should be occurring.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Skoy. I believe if we don't have a revenue estimate for this today, but I believe if we did have an estimate based on our assumptions, it would be a no-cost estimate if that is true. And we've been working on this for several months, and and have not found any recent audit activity in this area.
Yeah, so we have a little time, but if you could provide a revenue estimate before the final bill, that would be helpful.
Yes, we will do that.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Anybody else wish to testify for or against Senate File 1453? Seeing none, chairs lays over Senate File 1453.
Thank you.
Senate File 1453, as amended, is laid over. The next several bills we're going to be dealing with all have to do with sales tax that is currently imposed on local governments. And three of us have very similar bills. I think I'm going to invite Senator Senjum to come forward, and those who were planning to testify on my bill, if they would join Senator Senjum, Mr. Carlson, and the President of Association of Minnesota Counties. You'd like to join Senator Senjum. We'll take the testimony on that. But Senator Senjum, if you would present on behalf of Senator Weaker and myself about this issue, and then we'll go to Senator Chamberlain's bill, which also deals with the same subject, but from a slightly different take. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Madam Chair, yes, we have three bills before us. I'm going to speak to Senate File 329. I'm not exactly sure what your file numbers are as I sit here, but
I think they're all the same. Is that
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, the language in your bill, Senate File 329, Senator Wieger's bill, Senate File 104, and Senator Rest Bill 1523 are exactly the same.
And Ms. Pollack, do we need an amendment?
Madam Chair, yes. I believe there was an amendment in the packets that was identical, again, on all three bills.
And this is language from the department. I think
right.
You're familiar with it.
Right.
Do members have the language? We'll put that on right now. It's in the packet. Senator Senjum, you have a copy of it?
I have a copy of it, Madam Chair.
Okay, so this will be to Senate File 15, not to 1523, but to, if you'll correct that at the top, to Senate File Senjum's bill 329.
Madam Chair, do you want to amend it to all of the bills?
Well, we're just take yours.
Okay.
That we're only going to act on yours, so we just list the other ones. Okay, Senator Gazelka moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 1523. All those in favor? 329, I'm sorry. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Senjum, welcome to the committee.
And thank you, Madam Chair and members. Madam Chair and members, this is the Tax Reform Committee. I can think of no finer bill in terms of tax reform. In fact, I believe this would be a signature bill for tax reform of this particular legislative session if we were able to enact this. I remember well, Madam Chair, as a new city council member in 1992 and coming to a Rochester City Council meeting and learning about the fact that we were going to tax a tax. In other words, we collected property tax, but when we spent it, we were taxed once more on it, and it didn't make sense then, and it kind of doesn't make sense now, but moreover, through the years, you begin to understand that while there may not be reason and logic to some extent, it was all about the necessity back in 1992 of needing some money, and I'm not sure that necessity is necessarily gone, but I think as we think about where we are and where we're going, again, this is in my view, as we think about property tax relief in whatever form it might take, the idea that we might relieve government of sales tax, city and county in particular, townships have been alleviated of that a couple of years ago. I think it was 2011. I think would be a monumental decision for this legislature. Obviously, this would affect 87 counties and 833 cities. The cost, I think you perhaps have a fiscal note, it is expensive in the neighborhood of, for 14 and 15 of $244 million, and 16 and 17 rather, $268 million. I did a little research, at least in my own hometown, Rochester, Minnesota, last year paid $2.4 million in sales tax, and I suspect if you were to look at Olmsted County, you could nearly double that. Rochester and Olmsted County are basically synonymous in terms of identical governments, and so in the neighborhood of $50 million, and if you take a county of 150,000, I haven't done the math exactly, I suspect it's close to $45 a piece for every man, woman, and child living in my particular county, and I suspect to some extent that doesn't differ on a pro rata basis around the state. So I think this is common sense. It's logical. We have the potential here, I think, of a real signature bill if we could make it work. And so I'm proud to present it today. And with me to help do that, Joe Vern, Ven, rather. Is that right?
Benny is close enough.
Benny is close enough. All right. President of the Association of Minnesota Counties.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joe Vinney, and I'm a Beltrami County Commissioner. I also currently serve as President of the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC is a nonpartisan voluntary organization representing all 87 counties in the state. On behalf of Minnesota's 87 counties, I'd like to testify in support of the bills before you today that would provide a sales tax exemption to cities and counties in Minnesota and offer our great thanks to Senators Rest, Senjum, and Wigger for championing this important legislation. AMC believes that local governments should be exempt from sales tax. Under our current tax system, cities and counties funnel locally raised property tax dollars to pay state sales tax when purchasing equipment, office supplies, construction materials, and many other products. This sales tax shell game drives property taxes artificially higher and reduces transparency in the state's tax system. It's also important to note that local governments incur substantial administrative costs in complying with the current sales tax requirement. This includes daily and monthly compliance monitoring, as well as periodic reviews and audit preparation. In some counties, some larger counties, this compliance effort alone can require the equivalent of one or more full-time employees. The tax reform bills before you today would not only streamline the state's tax system, they could also help streamline local government administration. Those of you who have previously served in the legislature know this is not a new issue. Cities, counties, and townships have spent the past 20 years trying to regain the tax exemption, which we lost in the early 1990s. We were pleased that the legislature recognized the importance of exempting local government purchases from sales taxes last biennium when you chose to once again provide an exemption to township government. We hope that this year, a year of such promise for reform and fixing long-standing problems with the state's budget, you will choose to provide the same relief for city and county taxpayers. Once again, AMC strongly urges you to reestablish the sales tax exemption for cities and counties as you work this session to craft a better tax system for Minnesota. And on behalf of AMC, thank you, Madam Chair, and members, for your hard work this session on the important issue of tax reform.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Carlson, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We, too, would like to weigh in support of Senator Senjum's bill, Senate File 329, Senator Rest's bill, 1523, and Senator Wieger's bill, 104. We have been pursuing this reinstatement of the sales tax exemption for cities pretty much since the 1992 legislative session when the state decided to extend the sales tax to our purchases. Just as a side note, In that year, in 1992, as I recall, and I tried to look up these numbers, the cost to cities and counties and townships at the time was estimated to be a roughly $67 million. The actual full exemption beyond what is in the revenue note here would be roughly $150 million, but please keep in mind that this bill does carve out purchases made by cities and counties that would be rather competitive in nature with private sector businesses. That was a provision added to the township exemption in 2011, and that is contained in the bill. We do support the extension of the amendment to include solid waste and public health and dental facilities as well, so we do appreciate that. Let me just conclude basically by saying one more thing, or two more things. Minnesota is one of only eight states that I could find that tax local government purchases, and Minnesota is the only state in the last 20 years that has extended the sales tax to local government purchases, and the only state that I could find that it did it to solve a budget crisis. And then finally, please keep in mind that the sales tax also applies to state purchases and can actually transfer money from dedicated funds into the state general fund. The example is money spent on transportation-related projects that have the sales tax applied would actually convert money that we intend to send toward transportation into the state general fund as a source of general fund revenue. So with that, Madam Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Any comments for Commissioner Venny or Mr. Carlson at this point? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the counties and the cities. This was an either-or in 1992, I believe, when it was implemented. Well, I wasn't here. I think the history was the choice was either pay sales tax or lose your aids. And I think if you look at the revenue estimate, the new money proposed to go in this year probably wouldn't quite cover, but close. So as an either-or, which would you advocate for, the increase in aids or sales tax?
And that is, by the way, why we're going to hear Senator Reinert's bill, too, and so that we fully understand the, particularly for cities, because it is a reformed proposal in terms of delivering LGA, what are the questions and concerns if it wasn't either or. That you have, and I know there are many, but we want to have a really good discussion of that. Mr. Carlson or Commissioner Benny, Senator Senjum, if you'd like to respond to Senator Skoy's concern.
Madam Chair.
Hey.
Absolutely. Senator Skoy, the preponderance of responses from counties throughout the state of Minnesota favor the exemption on sales tax.
That over above or instead of getting the $40 million increase in county aid?
That is the preponderance of responses that we have received from Minnesota counties.
Commissioner Venny, the concern that we have is, and I'm very interested in this topic, both Senator Skoy and I, or in fact all of us are, is the distributional impacts. So county aid is distributed on a formula, and the sales tax purchases, of course, vary from county to county, and that there would be some counties that get far less in relief from the sales tax than they would in county aid. And that, I think, is, I don't know how we deal with that particular issue, and I think it's probably even more pronounced among the cities. But I don't know how much of the sales tax exemption for local governments is divided between counties and cities. Is that in the revenue estimate?
Madam Chair, it is.
Okay, where could you direct us to that then? Where's that?
Madam Chair, Gary Carlson with the League of Cities. I'm just looking at the Uyghur note. It does have on there a line item for cities and counties for the exemption. In the first full year.
I'm sorry. Of course it does.
In the first full year of the exemption, and I would point you to fiscal year 2015. 2014 is I think, 11/12 of a year.
Right.
But in the first full year, cities are estimated to have $73.3 million of liability and therefore savings.
Mm-hmm. So it's the increase that's proposed for county aid, I guess actually the issues are similar because the what is proposed for the increase in county aid from the governor, which I think you're going to see that we support, is roughly equivalent to what the sales tax exemption would be, but the distributional effects are going to be very different. So that does trouble us. I mean, I can see where, with the county program aid, I'd like to see the run on that, where it goes, and then, you know, it does 75% of it go to the metropolitan area? Would 75% of the purchases that are subject to the sales tax by counties also go to the metropolitan area? Is there, you know, are there equivalencies, basic ones? I mean, if it wasn't too skewed, it'd be very attractive, I think, to me. But if it's really skewed, then I think we need to be very careful about as we move toward that that policy preference. Senator Senjum,
I understand your point. It does seem to me that if you keep local government aid formula as it is, that it's simply like the tide dropping and everything drops equal and proportionally based on the spending of a city or a county. And it doesn't seem to me the ratios change very much, at least in terms of percentage. I could be wrong. It's kind of a mathematical thought here.
Right. Senator Skoy, comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Senjum, and to the testifiers, the formulas are need-based. So if a community has less wherewithal and more needs, they get more. Mm-hmm. Whereas the sales tax, those that have more buy more and benefit more. I mean, I think that's the distributional issues that we're debating.
Madam Chair.
And so
I'm sorry.
If I were you, I would say, do both.
That would be wonderful.
Madam Chair, if I
could respond briefly. And
Mr. Carlson, and then we'll hear from other testifiers as well.
And our policies do support doing both. And I know that sounds aggressive, but really keep in mind that LGA is still currently funded at about $139 million less than it was 10 years ago. We do think that program, and we'll talk about that in a minute, does need to be restored. And the sales tax piece also is an important piece that does affect cities across the state. I would like to also point out that cities vacillate in how much they purchase from year to year. And I've heard from many cities that in some years they purchase a lot more, and this would be much more of a benefit. In other years, they're doing less. So the benefits that would accrue can vacillate in a city from year to year as well. But we would urge you to consider both of these. They're both important policy points for our cities across the state.
When we think of the kind of the winners and the losers, depending on purchasing and who has the money to be able to buy as opposed to the need, the attractiveness to me of taking away the imposition of a sales tax is that I do see it as a turning off a spigot. I cannot imagine if we could get to the point of getting rid of the imposition of the sales tax on purchases by local governments that we would ever turn it on again. So, you know, it's like the local governments, maybe they because of their purchasing or their wealth or whatever, their needs, in the short term would benefit more from an increase in LGA. In the long term, the LGA, as you just mentioned, $139 million less than it was in 10 years ago. That might happen again. but if the sales tax is turned off, I cannot imagine a legislature or a governor wanting to turn it back on again, because we have had 20 years of experience with it, and I would say it's not been particularly good. And if one of the reasons for it was to dampen spending, because you have to add 6% to everything you're going to buy in looking at the cost to the local government and to the taxpayers, that would be gone. And it was seen as a way of dampening an appetite for spending. Apparently, that really hasn't happened because there have been needs that just have to be met with purchases. But it is a discussion that we're really interested in having. I see there are others that would like to speak to the bill.
Madam Chair.
And Senator Gazelka.
I just want to make a comment on your point, too. I think if we have an opportunity to turn off a spigot, you know, the taxpayer is still going to pay one way or the other. I mean, we're doing a fiscal note. There's a cost to the state, but it's taken off of the local governments. And I think, you know, it automatically means that everybody's a winner. You know, and I local government aid, many of my towns have it, but it's not a perfect formula in itself either. You know, where Baxter, for example, didn't get it and Brainerd got it, and, you know, Baxter was in a bind on a lot of things because they weren't getting it. But if we look at doing this one in particular, I think it's spread out. Everybody benefits from doing that, and hopefully it would never return again.
Madam Chair?
Commissioner Benning?
If I may make a final observation.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The sales tax exemption for counties would offer a degree of stability and predictability over time that does not now exist, and that would be my final comment, and that is the reason for the preponderance of support for sales tax exemption that emanates from our counties. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. Nowlin, welcome to the committee, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nowlin. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, and I'm just here to echo our support for the three bills before you to reinstate the sales tax exemption for local governments. This has been a longstanding policy of our organization, and it is one that gets rediscussed and revisited each year, and the same policy has remained on our books for a long time. And as previous testifiers have noted, this is a tax that is borne by local taxpayers, and we would encourage you to do both in terms of our policies also support both reform and increasing the local government aid program, but we also very strongly support having this reinstatement. So we would hope that you could consider doing both of those. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Nowlin. Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, members, I hadn't intended on testifying because both Ms. Nowlin and I had a meeting earlier this morning in Chaska and submitted a letter instead. And we certainly welcome the relief offered by the Chair's bill by Senator Senjams and Senator Wiegers. I do, however, want to at least give you a little bit of guidance on the distributional question regarding the impact of the county exemption versus program aid. Right now, we have a phenomena that probably the committee may well not be aware of. Because of exploding values in the agricultural sector and declining values, particularly in residential and to some extent in commercial industrial, we now have a phenomena where several of the greater Minnesota counties with significant agricultural or seasonal recreational values are no longer on the half of the formula referred to as tax-based equalization. Hmm. So they will receive less aid from an increase in program aid than the other counties. On the other hand, the one county that I have specific information on as far as their the benefit of the tax exemption, Dakota County, basically looking at the proposed increase in program aid at the $40 million level, they would receive three times more from the program aid increase than they would receive from the reinstatement of the exemption, but yet for the certainty that county would prefer the exemption over the program.
Mr. Carlson, with Dakota County and Senator Skoy, first of all, would you just repeat that? Because Mr. Carlson is speaking of the impact of the distributional effects on program aid in greater Minnesota counties and then in Dakota County. Senator Skoy had to step out for a moment. If you would just repeat that, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, regarding the distributional impacts of a program aid increase versus the benefit of the sales tax exemption, right now we have a relatively new phenomena that perhaps you're unfamiliar with because of exploding agricultural and to a lesser extent seasonal recreational values. We now have several counties that are no longer on the one half of the county program aid formula referred to as tax-based equalization. They're all in greater Minnesota. So they receive relatively less under a program aid increase than many of their counterparts, including all the metro counties. In terms of on the other hand, a Dakota county looking at the current runs, which they're based all on 2013 data, sees themselves getting three times more program aid than they would derive from the reinstatement of the exemption. Nevertheless, because of the certainty offered by the exemption, they would prefer the exemption rather than the program aid increase.
Very good.
It's just really, really interesting to us. You know, we wouldn't have this opportunity for this discussion except for Governor Dayton. And he is the one that has proposed investing in our local governments, in counties, and in LGA. But I think it's even more than just an interesting exercise to see whether that is the best way, using the increases that are there to help out our local governments. So the answers to all those questions about distributional effects, and then regardless of the distributional effect, if the stability argument means more to those that otherwise would benefit more under the program. And Mr. Carlson, with regard to Dakota County, you say they would benefit more in their own minds because of the stability. I think one of the things that we would want to look at with regard to the vagaries of year-to-year purchases or non-purchases is to get some sort of, you know, like 5-year average of or maybe even longer than that, so that it would be smoothed out rather than, oh, we had to you don't pay it on fire trucks, but let's say fire trucks were taxed, then you say, okay, we had to buy a fire truck 3 years ago, but since that time we've spent very little, or not very little, but our costs, you know, went down on purchases on sales tax. But if we had a 5-year moving average, even cities and counties could provide us with, I think we can make we can have a more meaningful discussion of that. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just kind of to the committee and to the public, maybe, you know, as we have worked on this in the past, we've kind of taken a categorical approach to it. We started with townships on gravel and graders and went to all, and, you know, maybe there's some categories that we could look at that would distribute broadly, and we could be doing a hybrid this year, too. I mean, mm-hmm. We don't have to look at this either 100% either or. Maybe there's some stuff that makes sense. So I think any information that you guys have that you can provide us would be helpful.
And I know Senator Skoy, and we're going to hear from Senator Chamberlain in just a moment about the impact his proposal about for cities with regard to non-LGA cities. The types of purchases are, if we do categories, we need to do that very strategically. and be able to have bright line sourcing, because the even though one of the biggest, as I understand it from City of Plymouth, one of the biggest category of items that the sales tax, they have to pay sales tax on, is supplies. But that would be very, very difficult to start listing what kind of supplies would be exempt and which wouldn't. That one, it's either you either pay it on everything or you pay it on nothing. But there are some, I think, identifiable categories that might be a more, again, a more bright line test.
Well, and Madam Chair, you know, perhaps transportation-related things. So we wouldn't be impacting CASA and that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Would make
yeah.
some sense.
So thank you very much, Senator Senjum, for your leadership in this, Senator Mr. Carlson. And we'll now ask Senator Chamberlain.
Madam Chair, may I just conclude with a sentence
Absolutely.
Or two?
Senator
I just
Senjum.
Wanted to say, you know, and I understand the discussion, and I would be hopeful that we could maybe explore this a little bit further and try to, if there's formula tweaks that we need to involve ourselves in to make this work, I think that would be important. But I just baseline kind of think, you know, what's right? Is it right for government to tax governments? And I think generally speaking, most people would say no. And is it right to collect either property or sales taxes at a local business, or pardon me, in a local community, and then pay taxes on them? That probably defies a little bit of logic as well. And I think if we could work our way through and out of this, we'd be better off for it. If it takes some formula tweaks to make it work, that would be our challenge.
Thank you very much, Senator Senjum. Senate File 1537 is now before us. Senator Chamberlain. Oh, and we will lay over Senate File 329 as amended, and just put aside Senate File 1523 and Senate File 104. Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess before we get started, there is a small technical amendment to this bill. Council was pretty sharp. They picked this up. What this technical amendment is, A1, author's amendment, it conforms the city, this conforms this legislation to what we did with towns a couple of years ago.
And it is the amendment that we just put on Senate File
yes.
329
right.
as well, so people are familiar with it. You have a copy of it?
Yes. Thank you.
So Senator Skoy offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 1537 as amended in front of us. Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing these bills today. I will forego any explanation. This is simply an add-on to some of the previous discussion with Senator Senjum's bill. This takes a smaller bite at the apple, though. It simply says cities that do not receive LGA will be exempt from the sales tax, have a sales tax exemption. All the other non-exemptions still apply. So. With that, I'll leave it at that. You've had discussion about the other issues regarding this. I will let Mr. Callister have a few comments.
Okay, and then I think we'll come back to some questions for you, Senator Chamberlain. Mr. Callister.
Madam Chair and Senators, Dave Callister, Administrative Services Director with the City of Plymouth. First of all, I want to point out I'm encouraged by the discussion that was just held on the last three bills. That is encouraging, and would support those bills, obviously, as a long-term solution for that. The history, we've heard it. I'm just going to touch a little bit on the history. The 1992, the LGA was made whole, and the cities agreed to share the pain by paying a local sales tax. That was 21 years ago. I've been in local government since that time. I was in local government then. Over those 21 years, I've been up here several times. I have talked to a lot of people. Not once did anyone say that was a bad idea to reinstate that exemption. So understanding where we're coming from is important, and that is we all think it's a good idea to reinstate that exemption, but there's never money, there's never a good time, there's never a good constituency really to make this reform. So what we're looking at today is to further your discussion on this by introducing Senate File 1537, which would exempt all cities that do not receive LGA from paying the sales tax. Is this a perfect solution to the issue? No. Is it ideal? No. But we're looking at it as, again, a starting point to try to head in the right direction. There are over 120 cities, depending on what year you look at, there's over 120 cities that are currently receive nothing in LGA. In fact, there are almost 1.9 million people living in cities that do not get LGA, which represents about 42% of the total population that lives in cities. So it's a huge number. And I think all we're asking for is kind of a seat at the table with regards to the discussions. We know that the LGA proposal has an additional $60 million in it for all LGA people that are eligible, all cities. We also know that the
Mr. Kelcher, pardon? That's the House proposal.
Okay.
That's not the Senate.
Okay, the House proposal is 60. Thank you for clarifying that. Is $60 million.
You got people's attention out there when you
say that. So we're thinking that this bill has a cost of $20 million, and we're trying to make it as equitable as possible. And the best way to maintain equity is to provide the sales tax exemption to all cities and counties, 100% supportive of doing that. In light of the proposals for the governor and the House with increases in aid programs, and I have talked to a lot of city colleagues, some who get LGA and some also are in favor of foregoing the LGA increase and getting the permanent fix, nothing's ever permanent, but longer-term fix, as Senator Ress mentioned earlier, it would be hard to put that sales tax back on cities. And I think it's the right thing to do. I think it speaks to what this committee is, and that is tax reform. There's never a good time. There's never enough money. This bill would start off with, as I mentioned, $20 million a cost, but I think it's headed the right direction. We're also open to some of the other suggestions, and we've identified some of those other costs, supplies, utilities, some of those ideas where, you know, partial savings. We know that there's never going to be enough money to do everything, and so we're open to those. But by presenting this bill, we're looking at a more long-term fix than LGA, because we know how volatile that can be for
cities. Mr. Callister, how much does the city of Plymouth pay in sales tax on their utility bills? You know?
The utility bills, gas and electric, we pay about $140,000 a year.
On costs
sales tax.
Of how much then would that be?
I think it was about $2
million. $2
million. In utility costs, heating and electric. So roughly in that neighborhood, $140,000, $150,000 that we're currently paying. And I want to emphasize there are a lot of good reasons that both of the three previous bills and this bill have said about why this is a good thing to do. But the biggest reason is transparency in the system. We do not like collecting property taxes from our residents under the guise of city services and then having to send that on to St. Paul. If there are revenue needs in St. Paul, then our feeling is that those should be very clear to all taxpayers that that's where the money's going. But by taxing our residents and then shipping off more or shipping off sales tax to St. Paul, we just don't feel that fits into transparency. And so that's probably the biggest item overall, is to try to fit this into transparency. So as I mentioned, this bill would bring some equity into the money that's going to or benefiting local governments. We realize it isn't the perfect solution, but it's a start in the right direction.
Any questions for Mr. Callister? Senator Dietzick or Senator Chamberlain?
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is to Senator Chamberlain or Mr. Callister. Have you done any comparison, or do you kind of know, are there any cities that would actually get more in a sales tax exemption than LGA that would want to then switch over if given the option? I truly don't know, so I'm asking.
I have not, Senator Dietzick.
Well, Senator Chamberlain's bill doesn't deal with LGA cities, but it's a good question.
Right, yeah, it might be.
Mr. Callister, among your colleagues?
Senator Rest, Senator Dietzick, the I can provide one example of a community similar in size to Plymouth nearby that does not get LGA currently, would get about $1 million, I think, under the new LGA. And the city manager there told me they would be interested in taking the sales tax exemption rather. They would forego the LGA. That's one example. I'm sure there are others. I know there are others that feel strongly that they would rather have LGA too, but those are my, in my experiences in the Western Metro.
Senator Gozelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McAllister, you may not know this, but I'm just wondering, on the local level, if we did away with that sales tax exemption, would there be any cost savings as far as FTEs? Would, you know, the larger cities, how many people do they have that have to be responsible for this?
Mr. Callister.
Senator Rest and the Senator, I don't know exactly. I know that we have probably 12 people in our finance department. I can't say there would be one full-time person, but I know there would be significant, meaning probably at least a half of an employee that would either we would be able to eliminate that position or put those duties into some other area. So it would free up a lot of time, both in local and I'm sure state, as far as collections as well.
You know, Senator, are you done?
Yep.
Senator Chamberlain, one of the issues is in your bill is that a city that does, or provisions, a city does not get LGA in the previous year would be exempt from sales tax purchases in the current year. And I think one of the reasons why this is not a perfect deal, a bill or an ideal bill is cities that certainly under Senator Reinert's bill, which we're going to hear in just a moment, they may go back and forth, getting LGA 1 year and not getting it another. Some of the cities that will get LGA in 2014 are not getting it now, and maybe in the future they wouldn't get it, but that they would be able to delay purchases until, you know, 2 years from now. Obviously, some purchases like supplies would not, and utilities would not be able to be delayed, but other things might be able to be delayed, and they would then delay those purchases in order to receive the tax break. And some would call that good planning. Others might call it gaming the system. So I think we do need to be cognizant of that as we're looking at these policies. Senator Chamberlain.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, absolutely. It's not perfect in its current state, and I often tell people that once you put a word or a comma in the statute, something else changes somewhere else, as you well know, and people will look for ways to plan and make it work. People are paid to do that. So I'd agree, and it's not perfect in its current form, but as Mr. Callister said earlier, this is a good discussion to have with all these other bills to maybe find a way to start, you know, changing it and fixing it.
Any other comments for Senator Chamberlain or Mr. Callister? Anyone else wish to testify in support or in opposition to this bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I would just like to tie together for a moment if we could. I don't know exactly how much is going to be proposed for an increase in local government aid.
We're going to hear that bill just in 2 seconds.
The Senate's proposal?
We're going to hear Senator Reinert's bill.
All right. I think that fits in here well, too, because that aid that's proposed to be increased for local government aid could be used instead to buy down
and
the sales
Senator
tax
Ortman,
provisions.
That has been the focus of the discussion on these bills.
I understand. Yeah. And I think it'll be interesting to see the numbers and how they relate, Madam Chair.
Anything else on Senator Chamberlain's bill? Thank you very much, Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Senator Ress. I could offer something with border cities, but we'll leave that for another committee.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Callister. Appreciate your
Madam
contribution.
Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Were you going to propose this just for border cities, Senator Chamberlain?
Chair lays over Senate file 1537 as amended. Senator Reinert. So the other half of the discussion on do we turn off the spigot or do we, what is the extent to which we not only have more money, at least as proposed by Governor Dayton, which makes that discussion, as I mentioned before, it makes that discussion even possible. But is there a, given that there is a proposal for additional local government aid, regardless of how much it is, and we know that in the House they're looking at increasing it, their proposal by $60 million, and we're looking at right now the governor's proposal in terms of the dollar amount, $80 million, and that is what the, your formula addresses. Is that not correct, Senator Reiner?
Yes, ma'am, sir.
And I understand we're, it is a new city aid formula. This is not directed at the county program aid, just the LGA.
Correct.
And that we, you've asked Mr. Paulson to go through the formula, the details of it. Would you like to make comments to start with, Senator Reinert?
I would, Madam Chair, and we do have an A1 amendment. I don't know when you'd like to take that.
Yes, we'll take it now. The A1 amendment is, has it been distributed?
It's in the packet.
It's in the packet?
I have it.
Senator Reinert, do you have a copy of it?
I do.
It's Senator Eden moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment, the promotion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members of the committee, been watching the whole discussion upstairs as well as about the last hour here in committee, so I know you've had LGA and that conversation woven throughout the last number of bills that you've heard. The bill before you that I've authored is the reflection of the work of several organizations that basically started getting together as soon as the governor came out with his proposed increase as well as his change in the formula. And I think it's safe to say that the change in the formula drove some interested parties to get together and talk about is there perhaps a better way to do that. So the bill contains the first significant update in 10 years on the LGA formula. If nothing were to occur within the LGA system this session, about 640 cities would lose local government aid in 2014. The committee has had a pretty robust discussion this morning on are there alternatives to that, and I think, Madam Chair, that's a great discussion that you're having. Many of the losers would be smaller cities due to the reallocation of the appropriation of the share of cuts amongst all the cities. One of the things, committee members, I think is really appealing about the product that this group that's worked together on this, and I should mention a couple key players have been the League of Minnesota Cities, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, amongst others. But I, you know, members, as I go home, as we all do, and talk with folks about the major pieces of legislation that we work on, and local government aid certainly falls into that category, being able to adequately explain it to someone in about 30 seconds seems to be the test. And for me, even when I was on the city council, LGA never met that test. And, of course, Duluth is an LGA recipient. I think this formula does that. We have a much cleaner formula that's easier to understand. There are no side pots. How many crashes occur in your city, how many car accidents you have no longer is a significant factor. There are no caps on annual increases. There's no need to measure more than three factors, and that makes it pretty easy to understand. There are three classes of cities, and within those classes of cities, we have no more than three factors for any given community. And cities whose current aid is furthest from their unmet need get proportionately larger increases to try and close that gap. The formula is also much more stable. All cities will now know their minimum aid for the next year in advance with increases determined by appropriation increases. So the legislature still controls the purse strings. Cities' aid won't bounce around, which it has done in the past. Factors change. Factors that change only affect the relative size of increases. So some specifics about the formula. The new formula makes adjustments to an individual city's aid based on its aid gap.
or the difference between its current aid and its unmet need as measured by the formula. I wanted to note that unmet need retains its current definition. It's the difference between a city's need per capita times its population and its adjusted net tax capacity times the average city tax rate. And as I mentioned, members, there are sort of three categories with factors for communities in each of those categories. And, Madam Chair, if it's okay, I thought I'd just walk through that.
Sure.
Great. So, members, for small cities, these are under 2,500 people, 2,500 people. The need factor increases with city population. It ranges from $410 per capita to $630 per capita on staff, and or if we want, Madam Chair, we can walk down into the weeds on that formula. For medium cities, and that members, that would be between 2,500 and 10,000, and I think the Chair correctly sort of pointed out one of the things we struggle with, and that's, you know, communities falling off a cliff when they fall below a certain number. And we've made an attempt to sort of have a little transition zone of about 500 people or so. But Madam Chair, you'll recall we've seen that already this session with a community that was, I think, 49 people below one of the magic limits. And members, we're not unique. I recall hearing a story at the start of session from the state of New York where a community, I think it was actually Niagara Falls, was right at the threshold for a similar program that New York does, and they were expected to fall maybe 100 people. So the mayor was out putting on a big campaign to get people to marry and have kids and bump them back over their magic level. Didn't seem to me like a short-term fix, but one that they were pursuing. So for medium cities between 2,500 and 10,000 people, the per capita need is based on three factors. And again, these are pretty clean, easy factors to understand. For members that are familiar with the way the formula is currently structured, you'll see how much cleaner it is. Number one, the percentage of housing built before 1940, which is a representation of the age of infrastructure. Number two, household size. Number of folks given it producing demand in a particular community. And then 3% decline in population of any from the highest census population count in any census on or after 1970. So those are our medium-sized communities, 2,500 to 10,000. And then lastly, for our larger cities, and that's defined by 10,000 or above, the need per capita is also based on only three factors. One is jobs per capita, and that's one that's particularly near and dear to my heart because it helps us represent the impact of regional centers, where you have more jobs than you actually have people within a community, so you have excess people in a community in a given day using city services. Number two, the percent of housing built before 1940, again, a representation of infrastructure age. And then number three, and this is a new inclusion in the factor, or in the formula, percent of housing built between 1940 and 1970. So members, for the first time, this gets at particularly first-ring suburbs who are now old enough that they have some of the infrastructure issues that those of us who are pushing 150 years old have been grappling with for some time. And I would just note that for transition purposes, no city's aid in 2014 would be less than its 2013 LGA amount. If they were declining, that would begin in 2015, and that decline would be limited to a 5% decline from the previous year. So, Madam Chair, I think I would stop there. If staff wants to drill down into more details, I'll leave that up to you, and then I have a couple testifiers.
Mr. Paulson, did you have anything at this point you wanted to add, or are you just going to be ready for questions?
Madam Chair, if you like, I can walk through the language of the bill. Otherwise, it seems like Senator Reiner did a good description of the bill.
Okay. I think we'll just use Mr. Paulson then as a resource if members or your testifiers even have questions about the language or whatever. Mr. Carlson, did you want to begin? Well, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'd like to give you a little background about the process that resulted in the development of this formula. And let me start by very briefly going back to the 2008 Omnibus Tax Bill. You may recall, for those of you who were around in 2008, the legislature directed us, cities and you, legislators, to come up with some new ideas for LGA. That was done in part because Ms. Nelman's organization identified some deficiencies in the way the LGA formula was working. But it also, perhaps more importantly, was due to the fact that we have recalibrated the LGA system about every 10 years. The regression-based model that is in place today was predicated on work that had been done way back in 1993. I think, Senator, when you were in the House of Representatives, it was a different way to come up with an LGA need estimate. In 93, that's when it was first implemented. In 2002, we recalibrated the system based on new census data, and we knew that there was a need to recalibrate the LGA system as we looked toward the 2010 census information and new data that was available. The current law formula that underlies all of this, again, is based on coefficients and statistical regression analyses that were done in 2002. And we know that things have changed for cities. We know it's time to revisit that formula. And again, in 2008, you told us to start thinking about this. We did do that. We didn't reach any great conclusions, but Senator Chamberlain, I think he's left now, actually was involved in that the end of that LGA study group and did make some recommendations. And I can mention that many of what the features of this new formula we believe reflect the intentions of the LGA study group recommendations that were adopted by that group in December of 2012. The formula we believe will result in a much more stable, predictable formula, as Senator Reinert indicated, and that's one of the big virtues of the formula. The simplicity maybe is best exemplified by the repealers in this bill. There are 7 pages of statutes repealed through this new formula, and I think that's a pretty incredible statement of taking away some of the side pots and features of the existing formula. And I think it will make, as Senator Reinert indicated, this formula much more explainable and much less complicated for the typical city official or the typical citizen to understand. We also believe it will be a more stable formula. Again, we took away the grandfather for LGA in 2002. We did notice almost immediately that that generated much more volatility for cities from year to year. And one of the challenges in budgeting around an unstable source of revenue is that you have to raise and lower your property taxes commensurate with changes in LGA. We think this new system will be, as Senator Reinert indicated, much more predictable. We'll know in advance what the minimum distribution is, and if we know the appropriation, we will be able to predict very accurately how much a city will receive in the subsequent year. There is no cap on the increase that can be provided by this formula. In the past, we've had to have caps to limit increases and decreases. This formula does not have an increase cap. The increase cap is basically limited by the appropriation change in the law, and that, again, is a stability factor. There are caps for reductions that would prevent a city from losing more than 5% of its certified levy in the previous year or $10 per capita. That does provide some stability for the roughly 90 cities that would lose some LGA under this formula. With that, Madam Chair, I guess the League of Cities supports this bill. Our Board of Directors carefully vetted not only the governor's plan, current law, but also this proposal. And before I could speak on this, they did direct me that they do support, rather unanimously, I should say, this as an alternative to the existing LGA formula and as a necessary update to the LGA system.
Mr. Carlson, would the League support the formula if the dollars were less?
Madam Chair, our position on the formula.
Is it on the formula or is it on the money?
We support the formula and we also support the appropriation increase, Madam Chair. As I started to indicate on the previous bills, this would get us, this proposal with the amendment would bring us $80 million more dollars for our cities, which gets us about 55 or 60% of the way back to the actual dollars distributed at the high water mark in 2002. So the dollars we feel are an important way to implement this new system.
Mr. Carlson, would the League support this formula if there were no increase in the total appropriation?
Madam Chair, I did not ask my Board of Directors that question, but I will say that Part of the value of this formula is that it is implemented with appropriation increases, and that helps transition the new formula into play. I really think the appropriation increases make the formula actually work and make it work effectively to start to redistribute monies.
The reason why I ask that is, you know, you talked in that right now LGA is $140 million less than it was 10 years ago. What if we have instead of our economy improving, that we have a catastrophe of some kind, and we have a huge downturn, and we need to cut LGA again, or we choose to cut LGA again. Would you still support this formula if LGA was cut? And maybe I realize that's a hypothetical, but one of the issues I think we've seen over time in any number of areas, including the 2002 tax reform bill, is that it only works, really works, if the economy is improving. If the economy gets tanked, then a number of the things that were proposed in property taxes and so forth are very concerning, and they don't work when like a lot of value in property goes down, or different kinds of valuations depending on the class of property goes up or down relative to others. And so the assumptions that were there with the 2002 reform really were dependent upon a steadily improving economy or valuation in property, et cetera. And I'm thinking more now about what's happened in the last 10 years with referendum levies in our school districts. So it does concern me when we do make a change in the formula that we don't think, well, next year we'll have another $80 million and that will make it even better. What happens with this kind of formula if the if we get into an economic crisis and one of the places where we make cuts is in local government property tax relief aids?
Madam,
do you have
Chair,
any comment on that?
Madam Chair and members, let me first say that, and I'm going to speculate a little bit about how my board may react here, but I do know that they understand that the formula does need to be updated, that the data that we're using right now is based on 2002 information and statistical regression calculations done in 2002. And I would speculate that the board would support using this formula regardless of the appropriation level. Let me say, though, that it has been typical, Chair Rest, that when you withdraw money from the LGA system, you withdraw it generally retroactive and after the fact, and we rarely use the formula to actually distribute a lower appropriation. That is part of the challenge that I think we had in coming up with a transition mechanism for this new formula, is that over the last 4 years, we've had repeated cuts in LGA, and most of those cuts have been done not through the formula, but by a very different mechanism. We've withdrawn the money generally as a percent of each city's rough budget or their Sure. revenue base. And that has created some of its own distortions in the LGA system that I'm sure Ms. Naumann will elaborate on. If this formula was to be used to reduce the appropriation to cities, mm-hmm. We may have to revisit exactly how that is done, because it's just not dawning on me as I sit here at the table exactly how we would cycle a lower appropriation through, I guess.
And I think that's a good point to make, too. When we have cut LGA, it has been on a percentage. We have not redone the formula to send it back out again.
That is correct. So
and
I
it has been after the fact. It's been, here's what we promised you, but guess what? You're not going to get it.
Correct. So I will think about that, and I will get back to you specifically
thank
on
you,
how
Mr.
that might
Carlson.
Function.
Senator Skoy has a question or a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Carlson, wouldn't the minimum loss that's in this formula make the reduction in LGA work pretty well? It would just everybody would go to that 5% loss first, and then it would become proportional?
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, that may be true. I might have to phone a friend here.
Well, it's something we can find out later on, Madam Chair.
Yeah, let's think about that.
But it just in my first look at it, I would think that that might work.
Ms. Nauman, did you want to give your testimony then, too?
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to comment today. Again, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. And we appreciate, first of all, we support Senate File 1491. We have appreciated the opportunity to work with the other city organizations to come to what is really an unprecedented agreement on a new formula. It's been very hard fought and hard to come by. And it, as Senator Reinhart pointed out, it was really the governor's task force and his advisory committee of mayors and his proposal that helped to propel us into this conversation. So we're very grateful for that. And this bill does provide for, in our opinion, a much more equitably distributed distribution of LGA across the state. It's easier to understand, and it is more reliable, which are all consistent with Metro City's policies around local government aid. LGA is a critical component of the state and local partnership, and in recent years it has been, as we all know, very significantly reduced over time. Cities in the metropolitan area have particularly been hard hit by those reductions, to the point where they've lost over 50% of their local government aid since 2002 at an aggregate level. Metro Cities has long supported LGA reforms that serve the needs of cities more equitably and that really serve to better address the needs of older suburbs in the metropolitan region, which are often characterized by aging populations, aging infrastructure, a significant amount of blighted property, increased poverty, and usually higher service burdens. These cities have really been long caught in a blind spot in the LGA program. This bill does provide significant improvements that acknowledges the needs of these communities and uses far more intuitive need factors, as well as reduces volatility in the distribution of LGA. And to that point, and this does reflect the $80 million increase that you're looking at, the distribution of LGA right now is 70% to Greater Minnesota and 30% to the metropolitan area, and under this bill, that distribution would increase so that 40% of the aid would be distributed to the metropolitan area. Again, we do appreciate the opportunity to be here today and look forward to working with you to move this bill forward. Thank you.
Are there questions or comments for the testifiers or Senator Reinhart? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Ms. Nauman, can you repeat the geographic split?
Madam Chair, Nauman. Senator Ortman, under current law, in the current formula, the split is 70% to Greater Minnesota and 30% to the metropolitan area.
Defined as the seven counties.
Defined as the seven counties, that's correct.
And under the
Senator
new
Ortman.
Under the new proposal?
It would be a 60-40 split, so 60% Greater Minnesota and 40% to the metro area, and that does assume an $80 million appropriation level.
Right, are there further questions or comments for Senator Reinhart? Senator Ortman, go ahead.
Madam Chair, can any of you address why newer cities don't also have infrastructure needs such that they should be factored in here too? And I live in one of those areas where we have some older cities like Chaska and we have some newer cities like Chanhassen or even brand new cities like Victoria or Waconia, where the infrastructure needs to meet the growing demand has been a real struggle. So explain, if you would, because I haven't read the report, why that's not considered as much a burden as in some of these older cities where they have to maintain what they have.
Senator Reinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Ortman, I'll make a few comments, but then I'll invite Mr. Carlson to add, or Ms. Nauman to add their thoughts as well. You know, traditionally the approach has been that the growth supports the building out of the infrastructure. For the communities who plateaued on growth or maybe even are retracting in terms of population and still maintaining that same infrastructure, those costs exceed the revenue being generated by any potential growth. It does beg the whole question of is that the philosophy we still want to adhere to and proceed down the road of, but that's historically been
the approach.
Members, I'm going to announce that we are going to go a little bit over. We do have two other bills that should be very shortly dealt with. They're not long discussions, so maybe another 15 minutes. But we will keep on this discussion right now. Senator, Mr. Carlson, did you have a response to Senator Ortman?
Well, I think Senator, Madam Chair, I think Senator Reiner described it very well. You know, we do, though, I want to point out, there are more cities on this new formula than the previous formula. We had 124 cities that did not receive LGA under the previous law. We've reduced that. I believe the count is 83 under this new formula. So about 40 cities come back onto the formula. And Madam Chair,
do you anticipate any of them, let's say if we kept this same way it is, no additional appropriation 4 years from now, would cities start falling off again or not?
Madam Chair, members, it really depends upon the functioning of the formula and the variables that each city has in the formula as to whether they would receive more or less LGA.
So when you talk about it being stabilizing, it still may, they still may get more or less in any, they're not going to continue to get the same.
Madam Chair, that is correct. It's not a grandfathered formula, so to speak. There are some redistributions going on within the formula. I would say the magnitude of that redistribution from year to year is reduced under this relative to the previous formula.
That's important as a stabilizing issue for
and,
it.
And if just to finalize my comment to Senator Ortman, these are proxy variables that we're using in this formula that we tried to analyze a lot of different data to come up with what we found to be the most, to have the highest explanatory power using statistical techniques. And just very briefly, Senator Rest, you would recall that back in the 1980s, one of the biggest criticisms of LGA was that it was largely based upon what a city spent, and if you
exactly.
spent more money, you could conceivably get more money out of the system. And back in 92, 93, we decided to go this different route. There were a lot of other LGA reform discussions. There was a LAD report. There was the CORE report. And the 93 formula was kind of a compilation of a lot of the ideas that existed at that time. And it was to find variables that were outside of the influence of local officials that best explained differences in spending. When we designed this formula, when we came up with these coefficients, this was a computer telling us what the statistical relationships were. We did not gerrymander these numbers at all. They were basically derived from the computer output doing statistical techniques. One last comment. Many of the newer cities have a bit of an easier time using special assessments for a new development in their communities because you can demonstrate a benefit under the special assessment law easier with new improvements to property. It's much more difficult in a fully developed community to use any technique like a special assessment because you have to prove a benefit to the property commensurate with the level of the assessment. That may be, I guess, a bias in this formula and a bias in the way Minnesota's special assessment law works, but I think that's part of this whole equation.
Ms. Nauman, do you have anything to add to that? Okay. Senator Ortman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The current law annually, according to the revenue note, shows $426.4 million per year for LGA. But by fiscal year 2017, the increases here would increase that by $103,000 or would require $103 million, excuse me. So over the course of 3 years, the proposal is to add $276 million more into the LGA formula. Am I reading that right, Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Carlson, I think the looks like to me the answer is in the second line, the growth. But
yeah.
Would you want to explain that?
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, I apologize. I failed to highlight a very important aspect of this formula, and that is that it does include an annual adjustment in the appropriation to help phase in the formula. The adjustment Part of the adjustment is similar to what we used in the 1990s in the LGA system, and that is to inflate the appropriation annually by the calculated annual change in the implicit price deflator for government goods and services. It's rather the consumer price index measure for cities and counties and state government. Added to that adjustment is a population growth factor that is intended to reflect the service demands of population growth on cities as well. The sum of those two statistics right now, I think, ranges roughly
2.7%.
About 2.7% inflation plus population growth is roughly 2.7%. And that is what is adding to that annual appropriation increase in the LGA formula. It amounts to, I believe, in the fiscal note, about $14 or $15 million per year.
Senator Ortman?
Mr. Carlson, can you point out, or Senator Reinert, where that language is in the bill?
Or Mr. Paulson, can you identify it quickly?
Madam Chair, that language is, Senator Ortman, that language is found on page 6, line 6.25 and following section 10 of the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps I can help Senator Ortman. I've, with the concern that the Tax Committee is having with balancing for 4 years, I think that the inflation adjustment is at risk of not surviving the process, and I would ask Mr. Carlson what the League's position is on the formula if he was to think that the inflation adjustment might not be in there.
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, in our board's direction to me, it was to support the appropriation increase, the inflation adjustment, and the formula changes. I would be glad to visit with them. We're meeting shortly here to discuss whether they would withdraw their support if the inflation adjustment went away. We still think, again, as I indicated earlier to Senator Rest, that the basic formula is a good improvement over the existing law. The appropriation increase would help restore some of those cuts over the past several years. One last comment. Again, the structure of this formula honestly works better with some appropriation adjustment per year to help phase in the formula. So I would like to continue the discussion with you, Senator Scoy, about whether we can secure some growth into the LGA system to help the formula function better and distribute the money better.
Mr. Carlson and Senator Reinert, Ms. Nauman, you may want to consider if there are alternatives, is it better to have a less of an increase with the inflation factor or the full $80 million flat without it? I think that's a consideration as well. Senator Ortman, do you have another question?
Final request from me, Madam Chair, is for our staff, Mr. Paulson, if it's possible to have a run like this done with the formula changes without the new money, because that way I think that we can evaluate what the changes do to the system without the money changes. I think that would help all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what we do have is we have everything but that column here. We have current law for both, and then what 2014 would be. But I agree. I think that formula applied, if it works, to the current amount of LGA for as a comparison. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in favor or in opposition who wishes to add something new to the discussion? We're shortly running out of time. Welcome to the committee. If you'd keep your testimony brief.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Nweik, and I'm a consultant to the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities.
And we do have two handouts that have the coalition's name on them that have been distributed.
Yes, thank you, Mr.
Van
Wyken.
Go ahead.
Mr. Flaherty couldn't be here this morning. He asked me to say a few words to you regarding Senate File 1491. I'll skip a few of my remarks in the interest of time, Madam Chair. The city LGA agreement contained in this bill is simpler, more stable, and more fair than the status quo. I'll restrict my comments to the inflation adjustment and to the appropriation increase. As part of the LGA compromise reached with other city groups, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota's Cities agreed to give up regional center aid and agreed to a smaller share of the future LGA distribution in exchange for a 2014 LGA increase of $80 million and an annual inflation and population adjustment to the appropriation in subsequent years. Inflation and population growth tend to push public expenditures higher over time. This is true of state government. It's also true of city government. Without an annual adjustment to LGA, the expenditure growth driven by inflation and population growth will be borne by the one major city discretionary revenue source, and that is the property tax. And those property tax will have to grow faster than the rate of inflation to make up for the aid to make up for what is not being picked up by the frozen LGA appropriation. Throughout the 1990s, as was noted, there was an LGA appropriation adjustment, and during that decade, real per capita city property taxes remained essentially flat. City property taxes began to exceed the rate of inflation in 2003 when we did away with the annual LGA appropriation adjustment and replaced it with annual cuts and annual freezes. Madam Chair, the CGMC would like to thank the Governor for proposing an $80 million increase in LGA in 2014, and we would like to thank Senator Reinert and his co-authors for including an appropriation adjustment in subsequent years that recognizes the long-term impact of both inflation and population growth. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Van Wyken. Mr. Barnhart, if you identify yourself for the record.
My name is Bill Barnhart. I'm here on behalf of the North Metropolitan Mayor's Association to make this very brief because Ms. Nauman covered a number of the items. We are especially intrigued with the formula in this bill compared both the governor's bill, governor's proposal, and this bill, in our opinion, have a lot of merit. We are very intrigued with what is in this bill for three reasons. Number one, it seems to do a much better job of recognizing differences among cities in the metropolitan area, which is another way of saying not all suburbs are alike. Some, as Ms. Nauman said, the wealth differences, the characteristics differ. This seems to pick that up. Number two, very important, this formula, as it is in the bill, is very scalable. If $20 million more was put in over the $80 million, which we would support, by the way, everybody would get around a 25 that are scheduled for an increase, 25% increase. If there was something less, I won't go into how much less, it would be proportionally. That is part of the understandability argument. And number three, and I think very important, this particular formula is fully phased in. The governor's formula, although it had a number of interesting attributes, was a very aggressive formula and would have taken 4 years, the proposal, to phase in, which is another way of saying 4 years of tension, heartburn in the municipal community versus this formula is fully phased in. So we are very thankful to the authors and the governor's effort, but the authors of this bill in particular.
Thank you, Mr. Barnhart. Any further testimony, either in favor or in opposition to this bill?
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. For Mr. Van Wyken, I'm having a hard time distinguishing. You've said that the formula eliminates the regional center aid in favor of the jobs-based aid, and I've always thought they've really done similar things. So can you just distinguish what you think that you've given up?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, just to be clear, all the side pots, including the jobs aid side pot and the regional center aid side pot and the small city side pot, are all eliminated under the new formula.
Well,
so I'm sorry if I misspoke in that regard.
Madam Chair, Senator Reinert, you said that the jobs are a new factor in the new formula, the number of jobs. Are you attempting then through your language to address both of those former side pots that Mr. Van Wyken is talking about?
Senator Reiner.
Madam Chair, correct. So number of jobs within a community for the large communities, 10,000 or more, becomes a integral component of the three factors for the large communities, along with age of housing stock in the community. It's no longer a side pot.
Madam Chair, I would just say then it's not really giving anything up if it's being factored into your new formula.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Senate File 1491 as amended is laid over. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take up Senate File 1492 first.
Please, Senator Rest, go ahead.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1492 deals with some technical language that is being proposed by the Department of Revenue addressing the current exemptions from taxes for nursing homes and boarding homes. A couple of years ago, we addressed the issue of property tax exemption, and what this does is to extend that to sales tax. And the need for it comes because there is a potential conflict, as I understand it, from them between the state's rate equalization law and the requirements that institutions of pure public charity provide services for free and at a reduced cost. So we did pass this language again several years ago with regard to property tax exemptions, and we are now proposing it also for sales tax. I think it's a very straightforward bill, and as I understand it, the revenue impact from the note is negligible. If there's anyone here to testify on it, but I think it's a fairly straightforward.
Yes, yeah, so Senator Rest, looks like we have a couple of testifiers.
Okay. Why don't you just have a seat? Maybe they could identify themselves, and then if members have any questions about what we're trying to do here.
Okay, testifiers, both of you, welcome to the committee. Whichever one of you wants to start, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota together with Aging Services. We're the long-term care imperative at the Capitol. We support the bill and have worked with the department and the author. It's a good bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Christian Knight with Aging Services of Minnesota, representing the long-term care imperative. I'd like to echo Toby's words that we support the bill. It's a good bill. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chairman, we need another witness sheet. We'll run out. So that's the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions for the testifiers? Okay. Senator Est?
Mr. Chairman, if you just lay it over, please.
Okay, the Senate File 1492 is laid over.
Mr. Chairman, the other bill is Senate File 1433, and it deals with what happens in sourcing when there are multiple points of use. And I'm going to ask Mr. Ines to come forward. We have in your packets a revenue estimate. It does have a cost. I would point out that the revenue estimate indicates, or there is a note there from the department, that it could put Minnesota out of conformity with a streamline. But we also know that. I believe from I don't have it in this folder, but in other analysis, there are other states that have done this, and the Streamline group has not raised any significant objections to reinstating this principle with regard to sales tax collections. But I'll turn it over to Mr. Ines to give you some background and why this would be a good policy to reinstate. We used to have a policy in Streamline, and then some other things happened with regard to online purchases in particular, and so the multiple use was put aside, but there's a reason to bring it back.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ines.
Thanks, Chairman. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines here on behalf of Ameriprise Financial Services. And I want to encourage this committee to seriously consider reinstating a multiple points of use provision. As Senator Rest rightly pointed out, there was a multiple points of use provision in law up until 2008. The Streamlined Sales Tax Board repealed their multiple point of use provision, and then Minnesota followed suit. I think now that we realize that this really is what I would characterize as a good government tax bill, in that it would enhance the ability for taxpayers to voluntarily comply with their tax obligation and also relieve the department of some of the administrative burdens associated with doing refunds. Now, the current fact pattern where this would apply, you know, it's for electronically delivered goods and services. So it's a fact pattern where you have an Ameriprise, for example, who purchases maybe 10,000 software licenses. And those licenses are going to be deployed across the entire enterprise. Maybe 2,000 of them are deployed in Minnesota. The rest of them are deployed across nationally across many different taxing jurisdictions. Currently, the vendor who sells those licenses usually looks at the invoice and says, okay, Ameriprise, headquartered in Minneapolis, I'll just collect tax on the entire amount of the purchase price and remit it to the state of Minnesota. Well, in fact, that is erroneously collected and remitted sales tax, because it's not being deployed in Minnesota entirely. So under current law, Ameriprise would have the onus to file for a sales tax refund from the department and clarify where they're deploying these sales tax or software licenses, and then they have to wait maybe 2-3 years to get the refund. This would say if a company like Ameriprise had a multiple points of use certificate, they could present this to the vendor selling them the software or whatever. That would relieve the vendor of the responsibility to remit the sales tax and shift that burden onto the corporation like Ameriprise, who has better knowledge about where the software or the licenses are going to be utilized. So it will enhance compliance, voluntary compliance. It should relieve the department of burden of processing a lot of refund claims. We have checked. In fact, there's been a revised revenue estimate that clarifies that this would not put us out of compliance with Streamlined. As Senator Rest rightly stated, there are multiple states that have MPU that are deemed in good standing with Streamlined. So that's not an issue. I will say Commissioner Von Mosch and the department have been very helpful. We met with them at length yesterday to try to address some of their concerns. We're currently working on an amendment to do some clarifying of some of the terms in the bill. I still am a little perplexed by the revenue estimate. In 2008, when this was repealed, there was a zero cost associated. So we have kind of automatically assumed there would be zero cost for reinstatement of it. There's still a fairly modest cost. The reality is we're not changing the taxability of any transaction. This may be associated partly with a shift as far as the refunds, and there's a shift associated cost. There may be associated with maybe some refunds. There aren't claims for certain refunds that are owed. People don't go to the hassle of filing a refund claim. So I'm not sure about that. The department could speak more informatively on the revenue estimate. But we always assume going in that it would be a zero cost. But they have clarified the streamline section.
Oh, good.
Senator.
And so we should be looking at an April 8 revised revenue estimate. So that the note that was on the April 1st one that I read to you has been resolved. So we'll make sure that people get that. It's the April 8th one, not the April 1st one.
Okay, any questions, committee members?
Chairman, one more quick point I forgot to make. This policy is supported by the Chamber of Commerce. They've thoroughly vetted this by their Fiscal Policy Committee. It's one of their official positions now. So this, and it's worth noting that, you know, Minnesota has 19 Fortune 500 companies headquartered here. This is the kind of provision that would really enhance their ability to pay the appropriate tax to the appropriate jurisdiction. So I'd strongly encourage the committee to seriously consider it.
Closing comments, Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman, I have no further thing to say.
Okay, and it's your intention to have this bill laid over?
Yes, sir.
Okay, if there's no questions, we'll lay over Senate File 1433.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, unless Senator Skoy has any announcements, I believe we are you just can adjourn the committee, but Senator Skoy,
A full committee will be meeting tomorrow and Friday this week, Friday morning.
And the division, again, will meet on Thursday, and we'll have the language for a proposed division report. The way in which we're going to handle that is release it then. We will act on it and amendments on Tuesday, and then whatever passes there will be introduced as a committee bill authored by Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair? Ortman.
Senator Ortman.
Yeah, thanks. When do you expect the governor's new tax bill to be introduced and heard in this committee?
Senator Skoy.
Thank you. Well, the bill's in the committee, and as we move forward, we very likely will be offering amendments to it. So I don't know exactly which committee day we will bring that forward, but I believe at some point we will be offering amendments to it if that's going to be the bill that moves forward in the Senate.
Mr. Chair, further clarification. So the committee won't have its own omnibus bill. It'll work off of the governor's bill and turn that into the omnibus bill?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, that will be Senator Skoy's decision. And I don't believe it's been made yet.
It hasn't been made.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, we just indicated that decision hasn't been finalized.
Well, Mr. Chair, my request would be that we get a chance to hear the governor's proposal and understand that proposal separate from the Senate's proposal if they're different. So we have the same information that you all have. I think that would help.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that governor's bill is that the language from that is out there, you will see probably in the bill that passes this committee any number of provisions that incorporate the governor's proposal.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, what I'm asking for is a hearing on the governor's tax proposals. I hope we're going to have that before we take up and pass an omnibus bill out of this committee.
Well, we'll take that request into consideration.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, you may adjourn the committee.
Okay. Meeting adjourned.